welcome back to the Cory Doctorow podcast. We're about to go into what EFF calls the quiet week, where all of our meetings are canceled. And I'm planning to spend the coming week, in addition to getting vaccinated and seeing some friends who are coming in from town for a backyard barbecue, I am also planning to spend the week reading through the entire Competition and Markets Authority report from the UK, all 480 pages of it, along with the congressional antitrust reports, which I confess I've only skimmed to date. So I'm hoping that there will be some interesting gems that I mine out of there. I've got some other stuff coming up this week and in the weeks to come. On the 7th of May, which is this coming Friday, the Gaithersburg Book Festival is hosting me as a featured author, and John Scalzi and I recorded an interview for that. John was my interlocutor there. The interview will air on May the 7th at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, and I will be live in the chat on YouTube, so we can talk about the interview while it's going on. This is, I think, actually a reasonably good way to manage this process. It's pretty cool. I will be speaking at a Knight Columbia conference called Reimagine the Internet on May the 12th, and I'm on a panel called Interoperability and Alternative Social Media with Daphne Keller, the specialist in intermediary liability regimes. And then I'm going to be hosting Aminder Dhaliwal for the launch of her second graphic novel slash comic book, Cyclopedia Exotica, on May the 13th. And on May the 19th, the Ryerson Center for Free Expression is hosting a talk by me called Seize the Means of Computation about adversarial interoperability and surveillance capitalism. So I hope you can make some or all of those, and I'm looking forward to seeing you there. Not much to report on the writing front. I continue to research and do background work on the next Little Brother story, which is a story I'm writing for one of the backers of the Kickstarter for the Attack Surface audiobook. It's a story about pipeline protests and Indigenous people in Canada and the US. And I'm still figuring out its contours, but I'm hoping I'll start drafting it this week. And apart from that, I'm just sitting tight and waiting to hear back from the editor who is looking over The Shakedown. That's the book that Rebecca Giblin and I wrote and turned in. And also my editor at Tor Books about the two novels I turned in last month. That would be Red Team Blues and The Lost Cause. So still waiting to get my editorial note on both of those. It'll be a while, I assume. And also to conclude the contracting for those two as well. So this week, I'm going to be reading part 5 of my serialized reading of How to Destroy Surveillance Capitalism. It is now looking pretty definitively like a 6-part reading, but it may end up being a 7-part reading, depending on how long I can go before my voice gives out. It's been a kind of an emotional week, and I'm ready to just take it easy a little. I'm reading a good book, and I'm anxious to get back to it, so I may not go as long as I have in the other sessions. If so, we'll stretch it out to 7 weeks, and that'll be okay too. And now, part 5 of my reading of How to Destroy Surveillance Capitalism, available as a free webpage, an ebook, and a print edition from Medium/10. Any data you collect and retain will eventually leak. The lack of a private life can rob vulnerable people of the chance to be their authentic selves and constrain our actions by depriving us of sanctuary. But there is another risk that is borne by everyone, not just people with a secret. Crime. Personal identifying information is of very limited use for the purpose of controlling people's minds, but identity theft, really, a catch-all term for a whole constellation of terrible criminal activities that can destroy your finances, compromise your personal integrity, ruin your reputation, or even expose you to physical danger, thrives on it. Attackers are not limited to using data from one breach source either. Multiple services have suffered breaches that expose names, addresses, phone numbers, passwords, sexual tastes, school grades, work performance, brushes with the criminal justice system, family details, genetic information, fingerprints and other biometrics, reading habits, search histories, literary tastes, pseudonymous identities, and other sensitive information. Attackers can merge data from these different breaches to build up extremely detailed dossiers on random subjects, and then use different parts of the data for different criminal purposes. For example, attackers can use leaked username and password combinations to hijack whole fleets of commercial vehicles that have been fitted with anti-theft GPS trackers and immobilizers, or to hijack baby monitors in order to terrorize toddlers with the audio tracks from pornography. Attackers use leaked data to trick phone companies into giving them your phone number. Then they intercept SMS-based two-factor authentication codes in order to take over your email, bank account, and/or cryptocurrency wallets. Attackers are endlessly inventive in the pursuit of creative ways to weaponize leaked data. One common use of leaked data is to penetrate companies in order to access more data. Like spies, online fraudsters are totally dependent on companies over-collecting and over-retaining our data. Spy agencies sometimes pay companies for access to their data or intimidate them into giving it up, but sometimes they work just like criminals do by sneaking data out of companies' databases. The over-collection of data has a host of terrible social consequences, from the erosion of our authentic selves to the undermining of social progress, from state surveillance to an epidemic of online crime. Commercial surveillance is also a boon to people running influence campaigns, but that's the least of our troubles. Critical tech exceptionalism is still tech exceptionalism. Big tech has long practiced technology exceptionalism, the idea that it should not be subject to the mundane laws and norms of meat space. Mottos like Facebook's "Move fast and break things" attracted justifiable scorn of the company's self-serving rhetoric. Tech exceptionalism got us all into a lot of trouble, so it's ironic and distressing to see big tech's critics committing the same sin. Big tech is not a rogue capitalism that cannot be cured through the traditional anti-monopoly remedies of trust busting, forcing companies to divest of competitors they have acquired, and bans on mergers to monopoly and other anti-competitive tactics. Big tech does not have the power to use machine learning to influence our behavior so thoroughly that markets lose their ability to punish bad actors and reward superior competitors. Big tech has no rule-writing mind control ray that necessitates ditching our old toolbox. The thing is, people have been claiming to have perfected mind control rays for centuries, and every time it turned out to be a con, though sometimes the con artists were also conning themselves. For generations, the advertising industry has been steadily improving its ability to sell advertising services to businesses, while only making marginal gains in selling those businesses' products to prospective customers. John Wanamaker's lament that 50% of my advertising budget is wasted, I just don't know which 50%, is a testament to the triumph of ad executives who successfully convinced Wanamaker that only half the money he spent went to waste. The tech industry has made enormous improvements in the science of convincing businesses that they're good at advertising, while their actual improvements to advertising, as opposed to targeting, have been pretty ho-hum. The vogue for machine learning and the mystical invocation of artificial intelligence as a synonym for straightforward statistical inference techniques has greatly boosted the efficacy of big tech's sales pitch as marketers have exploited potential customers' lack of technical sophistication to get away with breathtaking acts of overpromising and under-delivering. It's tempting to think that if businesses are willing to pour billions into a venture, then that venture must be a good one. Yet there are plenty of times when this rule of thumb has led us astray. For example, it's virtually unheard of for managed investment funds to outperform simple index funds, and investors who put their money in the hands of expert money managers overwhelmingly fare worse than those who entrust their savings to index funds. But managed funds still account for the majority of the money invested in the markets, and they are patronized by some of the richest, most sophisticated investors in the world. Their vote of confidence in an underperforming sector is a parable about the role of luck in wealth accumulation, not a sign that managed funds are a good buy. The claims of big tech's mind control system are full of tells that the enterprise is a con. For example, the reliance on the Big Five personality traits as a primary means of influencing people, even though the Big Five theory is unsupported by any large-scale peer-reviewed studies and is mostly the realm of marketing hucksters and pop psych. Big tech's promotional materials also claim that their algorithms can accurately perform sentiment analysis or detect people's moods based on micro-expressions. But these are marketing claims, not scientific ones. These methods are largely untested by independent scientific experts, and where they have been tested, they've been found sorely wanting. Micro-expressions are particularly suspect, as the companies that specialize in training people to detect them have been shown to underperform relative to random chance. Big tech has been so good at marketing its own supposed superpowers that it's easy to believe that they can market everything else with similar acumen, but it's a mistake to believe the hype. Any statement a company makes about the quality of its products is clearly not impartial. The fact that we distrust all the things that big tech says about its data handling, compliance with privacy laws, etc., is only reasonable, but why on earth would we treat big tech's marketing literature as the gospel truth? Big tech lies about just about everything, including how well its machine learning-fueled persuasion systems work. That skepticism should infuse all of our evaluations of big tech and its supposed abilities, including our perusal of its patents. Zuboff vests these patents with enormous significance, pointing out that Google claimed extensive new persuasion capabilities in its patent filings. These claims are doubly suspect. First, because they are so self-serving, and second, because the patent itself is so notoriously an invitation to exaggeration. Patent applications take the form of a series of claims and range from broad to narrow. A typical patent starts out by claiming that its authors have invented a method or system for doing every conceivable thing that anyone might do ever with any tool or device. Then it narrows that claim in successive stages until we get to the actual invention that is the true subject of the patent. The hope is that the patent examiner, who is almost certainly overworked and underinformed, will miss the fact that some or all of these claims are ridiculous, or at least suspect, and grant the patents broader claims. Patents for unpatentable things are still incredibly useful because they can be wielded against competitors who might license that patent or steer clear of its claims rather than endure the lengthy, expensive process of contesting it. What's more, software patents are routinely granted, even though the filer doesn't have any evidence that they can do the thing claimed by the patent. That is, you can patent an invention that you haven't actually made, and that you don't know how to make. With these considerations in hand, it becomes obvious that the fact that a big tech company patented what it says is an effective mind control ray is largely irrelevant to whether big tech can in fact control our minds. Big tech collects our data for many reasons, including the diminishing returns on existing stores of data. But many tech companies also collect data out of the mistaken tech exceptionist belief in the network effects of data. Network effects occur when each new user in the system increases its value. The classic example is fax machines. A single fax machine is of no use. Two fax machines are of limited use, and every new fax machine that's put to use after that first increases the number of fax-to-fax possible links. Data mined for predictive systems doesn't necessarily produce these dividends. Think of Netflix. The predictive value of the data mined from a million English-speaking Netflix viewers is hardly improved by the addition of one more user's viewing data. Most of the data Netflix acquires after that first minimum viable sample duplicates existing data and produces only minimal gains. Meanwhile, retraining models with the new data gets progressively more expensive as the number of data points increases, and manual tasks like labeling and validating data do not get cheaper at scale. Businesses pursue fads to the detriment of their profits all the time, especially when the businesses and their investors are not motivated by the prospect of becoming profitable, but rather by the prospect of being acquired by a big tech company or by having an IPO. For these firms, ticking faddish boxes like collect as much data as possible might realize a bigger return on investment than collects a business-appropriate quantity of data. This is another harm of tech exceptionalism, the belief that more data always produces more profits in the form of more insights that can be translated into better mind control rays, drives firms to over-collect and over-retain data beyond all rationality, And since the firms are behaving irrationally, a good number of them will go out of business and become ghost ships whose cargo holds are stuffed full of data that can harm people in myriad ways, but which no one is responsible for any longer. Even if the companies don't go under, the data they collect is maintained behind the minimum viable security, just enough security to keep the company viable while it waits to get bought out by a tech giant, an amount calculated to spend not one penny more than is necessary on protecting our data. How monopolies, not mind control, drive surveillance capitalism. The Snapchat story. For the first decade of its existence, Facebook competed with the social media giants of the day, MySpace, Orkut, etc., by presenting itself as the pro-privacy alternative. Indeed, Facebook justified its walled garden, which let users bring in data from the web, but blocked web services like Google Search from indexing and caching Facebook pages, as a pro-privacy measure that protected users from the surveillance-happy winners of the social media wars like MySpace. Despite frequent promises that it would never collect or analyze its users' data, Facebook periodically created initiatives that did just that, like the creepy, hand-fisted beacon tool, which spied on you as you moved around the web, then added your online activities to your public timeline, allowing your friends to monitor your browsing habits. Beacon sparked a user revolt. Every time, Facebook backed off from its surveillance initiative, but not all the way. Inevitably, the new Facebook would be more surveilling than the old Facebook, though not quite as surveilling as the intermediate Facebook following the launch of the new product or service. The pace at which Facebook ramped up its surveillance efforts seems to have been set by Facebook's competitive landscape. The more major competitors Facebook had, the better it behaved. Every time a major competitor foundered, Facebook's behavior got markedly worse. All the while, Facebook was prodigiously acquiring companies, including a company called Onavo. Nominally, Onavo made a battery monitoring mobile app, but the permissions that Onavo required were so extensive that the app was able to gather fine-grained telemetry on everything users did with their phones, including which apps they used and how they were using them. Through Onavo, Facebook discovered that it was losing market share to Snapchat, an app that, like Facebook a decade before, billed itself as a pro-privacy alternative to the status quo. Through Onavo, Facebook was able to mine data from the devices of Snapchat users, including both current and former Snapchat users. This spurred Facebook to acquire Instagram, some features of which competed with Snapchat, and then allowed Facebook to fine-tune Instagram's features and sales pitch to erode Snapchat's gains and ensure that Facebook would not have to face the kind of competitive pressures it had earlier inflicted on MySpace and Orkut. The story of how Facebook crushed Snapchat reveals the relationship between monopoly and surveillance capitalism. Facebook combined surveillance with lax antitrust enforcement to spot the competitive threat of Snapchat on its horizon and then take decisive action against it. Facebook's surveillance capitalism let it avert competitive pressure with anti-competitive tactics. Facebook users still want privacy. Facebook hasn't used surveillance to brainwash them out of it. But they can't get it, because Facebook's surveillance lets it destroy any hope of a rival service emerging that competes on privacy features. A monopoly over your friends. A decentralization movement has tried to erode the dominance of Facebook and other big tech companies by fielding indie web alternatives, Mastodon as a Twitter alternative, Diaspora as a Facebook alternative, etc. But these efforts have failed to attain any kind of liftoff. Fundamentally, each of these services is hamstrung by the same problem. Every potential user for a Facebook or Twitter alternative has to convince all of their friends to follow them to a decentralized web alternative in order to continue to realize the benefit of social media. For many of us, the only reason to have a Facebook account is that our friends have Facebook accounts. And the reason they have Facebook accounts is that we have Facebook accounts. All of this has conspired to make Facebook and the other dominant platforms into kill zones that investors will not fund new entrants for. And yet, all of today's tech giants came into existence despite the entrenched advantage of the companies that came before them. To understand how that happened, you have to understand both interoperability and adversarial interoperability. Interoperability is the ability of two technologies to work with one another. Anyone can make an LP that will play on any record player. Anyone can make a filter that you can install on your stove's extractor fan. Anyone can make gasoline for your car. Anyone can make a USB phone charger that fits in your car's cigarette lighter receptacle. Anyone can make a light bulb that works in your light socket. And anyone can make bread that will toast in your toaster. Interoperability is often a source of innovation and consumer benefit. Apple made the first commercially successful PC, but millions of independent software vendors made interoperable programs that ran on the Apple II Plus. The simple analog antenna inputs on the back of TVs first allowed cable operators to connect directly to TVs. Then they allowed game console companies and then personal computer companies to use standard televisions as displays. Standard RJ11 telephone jacks allowed for the production of phones from a variety of vendors in a variety of forms, from the free football-shaped phone that came with a Sports Illustrated subscription to business phones with speakers, hold functions, and so on, and then to answering machines and finally modems, paving the way for the internet revolution. Interoperability is often used interchangeably with standardization, which is the process when manufacturers and other stakeholders hammer out a set of agreed-upon rules for implementing a technology, such as the electrical plug on your wall, the CAN bus used by your car's computer systems, or the HTML instructions that your browser interprets. But interoperability doesn't require standardization. Indeed, standardization often proceeds from the chaos of ad hoc interoperability measures. The inventor of the cigarette lighter USB charger did not need to get permission from car manufacturers or even the manufacturers of the dashboard lighter subcomponent. The automakers didn't take any countermeasures to prevent the use of these aftermarket accessories by their customers, but they also didn't do anything to make life easier for the charger's manufacturers. This is a kind of neutral interoperability. Beyond neutral interoperability, there is adversarial interoperability. That's when a manufacturer makes a product that interoperates with another manufacturer's product, despite the second manufacturer's objections, and even if that means bypassing a security system designed to prevent interoperability. Probably the most familiar form of adversarial interoperability is third-party printer ink. Printer manufacturers claim that they sell printers below cost, and that the only way they can recoup the losses they incur is by charging high markups on ink. To prevent the owners of printers from buying ink elsewhere, the printer companies deploy a suite of anti-customer security systems that detect and reject both refilled and third-party cartridges. Owners of printers take the position that HP and Epson and Brother are not charities, and that customers for their wares have no obligation to help them survive. And so if the companies choose to sell their products at a loss, that's their foolish choice, and there are consequences to live with. Likewise, competitors who make ink or refill kits observe that they don't owe the printer companies anything, that their erosion of the printer company's margins are the printer company's problems, not their competitors. After all, if the printer companies shed no tears when they drive a refiller out of business, why should the refillers concern themselves with the economic fortunes of the printer companies? Adversarial interoperability has played an outsized role in the history of the tech industry, from the founding of the Alt Usenet hierarchy, which started against the wishes of Usenet's maintainers and which grew to be bigger than all of Usenet combined, and the browser wars, when Netscape and Microsoft devoted massive engineering efforts to making their browsers incompatible with the other special commands and peccadilloes, to Facebook, whose success was built in part by helping its new users stay in touch with the friends they'd left behind on MySpace because Facebook supplied them with a tool that scraped waiting messages from MySpace and imported them into Facebook, effectively creating a Facebook-based MySpace reader. Today, incumbency is seen as an unassailable advantage. Facebook is where all of your friends are, so no one can start a Facebook competitor. But adversarial interoperability reverses the competitive advantage. But adversarial interoperability reverses the competitive advantage. If you were allowed to compete with Facebook by providing a tool that imported all your users' waiting Facebook messages into an environment that competed on lines that Facebook couldn't cross, like eliminating surveillance and ads, then Facebook would be at a huge disadvantage. it would have assembled all possible ex-Facebook users into a single, easy-to-find service. It would have educated them on how a Facebook-like service worked and what its potential benefits were. And it would have provided an easy means for disgruntled Facebook users to tell their friends where they might expect better treatment. Adversarial interoperability was once the norm, and a key contributor to the dynamic, vibrant tech scene. But now it is stuck behind a thicket of laws and regulations that add legal risks to the tried and true tactics of adversarial interoperability. New rules and new interpretations of existing rules mean that a would-be adversarial interoperator needs to steer clear of claims under copyright, terms of service, trade secrecy, tortious interference, and patent. In the absence of a competitive market, lawmakers have resorted to assigning expensive state-like duties to big tech firms, such as automatically filtering user contributions for copyright infringement, or terrorist and extremist content, or detecting and preventing harassment in real time, or controlling access to sexual material. These measures put a floor under how small we can make big tech, because only the very largest companies can afford the humans and automated filters needed to provide these duties. But that's not the only way in which making platforms responsible for policing their users undermines competition. A platform that is expected to police its users' content must prevent many vital adversarial interoperability techniques, lest these subvert its policing measures. For example, if someone using a Twitter replacement like Mastodon is able to push messages into Twitter and read messages out of Twitter, they could avoid being caught by automated systems that detect and prevent harassment, such as systems that use the timing of messages or IP-based rules to make guesses about whether someone is a harasser. To the extent that we are willing to let big tech police itself, rather than making big tech small enough that users can leave bad platforms for better ones, and small enough that a regulation that simply puts a platform out of business will not destroy billions of users' access to their communities and data, we build the case that big tech should be able to block its competitors and make it easier for big tech to demand legal enforcement tools to ban and punish attempts at adversarial interoperability. Ultimately, we can try to fix big tech by making it responsible for bad acts by its users, or we can try to fix the internet by cutting big tech down to size. But we can't do both. To replace today's giant products with pluralistic protocols, we need to clear the legal thicket that prevents adversarial interoperability so that tomorrow's nimble, personal, small-scale products can federate themselves with giants like Facebook, allowing the users who've left to continue to communicate with the users who haven't left yet, reaching tendrils over Facebook's garden wall that Facebook's trapped users can use to scale those walls and escape to the global, open web. Fake news is an epistemological crisis. Tech is not the only industry that has undergone massive concentration since the Reagan era. Virtually every major industry, from oil to newspapers to meatpacking to sea freight to eyewear to online pornography, has become a clubby oligarchy that just a few players dominate. At the same time, every industry has become something of a tech industry, as general-purpose computers and general-purpose networks and the promise of efficiencies through data-driven analysis infuse every device, process, and firm with tech. This phenomenon of industrial concentration is part of a wider story about wealth concentration overall, as a smaller and smaller number of people own more and more of our world. This concentration of both wealth and industries means that our political outcomes are increasingly beholden to the parochial interests of the people and companies with all the money. This means that whenever a regulator asks a question with an obvious empirical answer, are humans causing climate change, or should we let companies conduct commercial mass surveillance, or does society benefit from allowing net neutrality violations? The answer that comes out is only correct if that correctness meets with the approval of rich people and the industries that made them so wealthy. Rich people have always played an outsized role in politics, and more so since the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision eliminated key controls over political spending. Widening inequality and wealth concentration means that the very richest people are now a lot richer and can afford to spend a lot more money on political projects than ever before. Think of the Koch brothers, or George Soros, or Bill Gates. But the policy distortions of rich individuals pale in comparison to the policy distortions that concentrated industries are capable of. The companies in highly concentrated industries are much more profitable than companies in competitive industries. No competition means not having to reduce prices or improve quality to win customers, leaving them with bigger capital surpluses that they can spend on lobbying. Concentrated industries also find it easier to collaborate on policy objectives than competitive ones. When all the top executives from your industry can fit around a single boardroom table, they often do. And when they do, they can forge a consensus position on regulation. Rising through the ranks in a concentrated industry generally means working at two or three of the big companies. When there are only a relative few companies in a given industry, each company has a more ossified executive rank, leaving ambitious execs with fewer paths to higher positions, unless they're recruited to a rival. This means that the top execs in concentrated industries are likely to have been colleagues at some point and socialize in the same circles, connected through social ties or, say, serving as the trustees for each other's estates. These tight social bonds foster a collegial, rather than competitive, attitude. Highly concentrated industries also present a regulatory conundrum. When an industry is dominated by just four or five companies, the only people who are likely to truly understand the industry's practices are its veteran executives. This means that top regulators are often former executives of the companies they are supposed to be regulating. These turns in government are often tacitly understood to be leaves of absence from industry, with former employers welcoming their erstwhile watchdogs back into their executive ranks once their terms have expired. All this is to say that the tight social bonds, small number of firms, and regulatory capture of concentrated industries give the companies that comprise them the power to dictate many, if not all, of the regulations that bind them. This is increasingly obvious. Whether it's payday lenders winning the right to practice predatory lending, or Apple winning the right to decide who can fix your phone, or Google and Facebook winning the right to breach your private data without suffering meaningful consequences, or victories for pipeline companies, or impunity for opioid manufacturers, or massive tax subsidies for incredibly profitable dominant businesses, it's increasingly apparent that many of our official, evidence-based, truth-seeking processes are, in fact, auctions for sale to the highest bidder. It's really impossible to overstate what a terrifying prospect this is. We live in an incredibly high-tech society, and none of us could acquire the expertise to evaluate every technological proposition that stands between us and our untimely, horrible deaths. You might devote your life to acquiring the media literacy to distinguish good scientific journals from corrupt, pay-for-play lookalikes, and the statistical literacy to evaluate the quality of the analysis in the journals, as well as the microbiology and epidemiology knowledge to determine whether you can trust claims about the safety of vaccines, but that would still leave you unqualified to judge whether the wiring in your home will give you a lethal shock, and whether your car's brake software will cause them to fail unpredictably, and whether the hygiene standards at your butcher are sufficient to keep you from dying after you finish your dinner. In a world as complex as this one, we have to defer to authorities, and we keep them honest by making those authorities accountable to us and binding them with rules to prevent conflicts of interest. We can't possibly acquire the expertise to adjudicate conflicting claims about the best ways to make the world safe and prosperous, but we can determine whether the adjudication process itself is trustworthy. Right now, it's obviously not. The past 40 years of rising inequality and industry concentration, together with increasingly weak accountability and transparency for expert agencies, has created an increasingly urgent sense of impending doom, the sense that there are vast conspiracies afoot that operate with tacit official approval, despite the likelihood that they are working to better themselves by ruining us. For example, it's been decades since Exxon's own scientists concluded that its products would render the Earth uninhabitable by humans. And yet those decades were lost to us, in large part because Exxon lobbied governments and sowed doubt about the danger of its products, and did so with the cooperation of many public officials. When the survival of you and everyone you love is threatened by conspiracies, it's not unreasonable to start questioning the things that you think you know in an attempt to determine whether they, too, are the outcome of another conspiracy. The collapse of the credibility of our systems for divining and upholding truths has left us in a state of epistemological chaos. Once, most of us might have assumed that the system was working, and that our regulations reflected our best understanding of the empirical truths of the world as they were best understood. Now, we have to find our own experts to help us sort the true from the false. If you're like me, you probably believe that vaccines are safe. But you, like me, probably also can't explain the microbiology or statistics. Few of us have the math skills to review the literature on vaccine safety and describe why their statistical reasoning is sound. Likewise, few of us can review the stats in the now discredited literature on opioid safety and explain how those stats were manipulated. Both vaccines and opioids were embraced by medical authorities, after all, and one is safe while the other could ruin your life. You're left with a kind of inchoate constellation of rules of thumb about which experts you trust to fact-check controversial claims, and then to explain how all these respectable doctors with their peer-reviewed research on opioid safety were an aberration, and then how you know that the doctors writing about vaccine safety are not an aberration. I am 100% certain that vaccinating is safe and effective. But I'm also at something of a loss to explain exactly, precisely, why I believe this, given all the corruption I know about, and the many times that the stamp of certainty has turned out to be a parochial lie told to further enrich the super rich. Fake news, conspiracy theories, racist ideologues, scientific denialism has always been with us. What's changed today is not the mix of ideas in the public discourse, but the popularity of the worst ideas in that mix. Conspiracy and denial have skyrocketed in lockstep with the growth of big inequality, which has also tracked the rise of big tech and big pharma and big wrestling and big car and big movie theater and big everything else. No one can say for certain why this has happened, but the two dominant camps are idealism, the belief that the people who argue for these conspiracies have gotten better at explaining them, maybe with the help of machine learning tools, or materialism. The ideas have become more attractive because of material conditions in the world. I'm a materialist. I've been exposed to the arguments of conspiracy theorists all my life, and I've not experienced any qualitative leap in the quality of these arguments. The major difference is in the world, not the arguments. In a time where actual conspiracies are commonplace, conspiracy theories acquire a ring of plausibility. We have always had disagreements about what's true, but today we have a disagreement over how we know something is true. This is an epistemological crisis, not a crisis in belief. It's a crisis over the credibility of our truth-seeking exercises from scientific journals, in an era where the biggest journal publishers have been caught producing pay-to-play journals for junk science, to regulations, in an era where regulators are routinely cycling in and out of business, to education, in an era where universities are dependent on corporate donations to keep their lights on. Targeting, surveillance capitalism, makes it easier to find people who are undergoing this epistemological crisis, but it didn't create the crisis. For that, you need to look to corruption. And, conveniently enough, it's corruption that allows surveillance capitalism to grow by dismantling monopoly protections, by permitting reckless collection and retention of personal data, by allowing ads to be targeted in secret, and by foreclosing on the possibility of going somewhere else where you might continue to enjoy your friends without subjecting yourself to commercial surveillance. Okay, folks, that's it. I did, in fact, read half of the remainder, so I think next week will be the last one. Have a great week. Next time I speak to you, I will have had my second vaccine. Wish me luck.
You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike US 3.0. Or as Woody Guthrie put it in another context, this song is copyrighted in the US under Seal of Copyright 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ourn, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Many thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's Ryneck Studio, W-R-Y-N-E-C-K Studio, @gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is a full-time self-employed audio engineer, producer, composer, and sound designer. In his free time, he makes beer, jewelry, odd musical instruments, and furniture. He likes to meditate, to read, and to cook. Talk to you next week.